This is Justice Talking, the public radio show about law, justice, and American life. I'm Margot Adler. Today we're looking at health care reform, a major issue in this presidential campaign. Each candidate has weighed in with his or her plan to overhaul the system.
We've got the best health care in the world. It costs more than it should. We can either go one of two ways. We can let the government take it over, and they'll lower costs like they do in other countries. We will also sacrifice care.
The single most important element is, does it cover everybody? Because if it doesn't cover everybody, then I think whoever the candidate is should be made to explain what American they believe is not worthy of health care coverage.
Only 17 million Americans right now buy their own health insurance. If 50 million Americans were buying their own health insurance, because it would be just as tax advantageous to do it that way, and we had a health savings account.
Because I believe if we don't have universal health care, we will never provide prevention. I have the most aggressive measures to reduce costs and improve quality.
She would force, in some fashion, individuals to purchase health care. If it was not affordable, she would still presumably force them to have it unless there is a hardship exemption as they've done in Massachusetts.
I don't think that there should be a mandate for every American to have health insurance. But I'm not going to mandate that every American go to college. I feel the same way about health care. If it's affordable and available, then it seems to me that, again, it's a matter of choice amongst Americans.
Senators Obama and Clinton are both strong proponents of universal health care. Their disagreements lie in how to achieve that goal. But some say it's time to go further and make health care a right. Democratic Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. has proposed a constitutional amendment that would do just that. But what would it mean if health care were a right? Joining me to debate this are Russell Roberts and Dr. Quentin Young. Russ Roberts is a professor of economics at George Mason University and a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Quentin Young is a practicing internist and teaches preventative medicine and community health at the University of Illinois Medical Center. He is co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Welcome, both of you, to Justice Talking.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Most people agree that our current healthcare system needs dramatic reform. Should healthcare be a right? I'd like you both to respond. Quentin, let's start with you.
Well, I emphatically believe and have for almost all my professional life that it is a right, that any other approach to the problem of healthcare is going to come a cropper. Now, having said that, I don't mean remotely to imply it's recognized as a right or practiced as a right in this country. Other countries do operate on that principle. But in brief, I emphatically believe it's a right.
Russ, how about you?
Well, for me, it's not a matter of belief. It's a nice idea for everyone to have health care. It'd be even better if everyone had phenomenal health care. And it's a better world where no one ever gets sick and lives to 120. But that's not the real world. The real question is how we treat healthcare as a public policy issue in the real world depends on the incentives we face as consumers and as doctors and as bureaucrats. And I worry about how those incentives are structured. And when we talk about something as a right, we're basically moving away and ignoring those incentives. And we're going to move to a world where I think healthcare will be enjoyed by everyone, but I worry at a very low level.
Mm-hmm. So what about the idea that it might be in our national interest to make sure everyone gets adequate medical care?
What does that mean in our national interest?
Well, essentially that it's good for our country.
What does that mean, good for our country? It would be good for me to have more health care than I have now. It would be good for you. Question is, how do we pay for it? And how do we make sure that the people who we worry don't get enough health care get it, and the people who have plenty don't get more than that and throw waste resources? So I don't think there's any way you can talk about the nation's health care. As individuals, we all have different incentives and different resources, and we want to see people taken care of, obviously. The question is, how do you do that in the most effective way possible?
Quentin, you want to respond?
I do. It is in the national interest to have good health status, whether it's workers in the workforce not missing time because they're ill or parents being able to be good parents because their health is maintained. We have in this country a model, a flawed model, but much better than anything else we've got in the world of Medicare, where in 1965 Congress passed and the president signed a bill that made everybody over 65 a beneficiary, and later fully disabled people were added to the group. And this group has enjoyed this benefit happily, while the rest of the systems were almost invariably bad.
Russ, I'm going to assume that you would say there's a problem with Medicare.
Well, Medicare is pretty effective and also very expensive. The real question is, what happens if we made it a model? It's always easy to take a little corner of the healthcare field and say, well, this is working well. The question is, would it work well if it were writ large? We often have this debate about healthcare as if it were a theoretical conversation. What might the world look like if we moved to a world of, say, nationalized healthcare? Well, most, as Quentin points out, many nations in the world have national healthcare, and we see all the good things and all the bad things about it. The good thing is that most people get healthcare. The bad thing is that the healthcare they get tends to be mediocre.
Quentin, what?
I'd like to comment on the little corner. 43 million people enjoy Medicare. I don't buy the erroneous view that America is singularly more innovative and that the rest of these nationalized systems are, you know, mediocre care, as you put it. It's excellent care. The health standards in each of these countries, by the usual ways we define health standards, life expectancy, freedom from preventable disease, infant mortality, maternal mortality, they're all way ahead of us to an embarrassing degree. We're not in the first 10, first 20. We're usually in the 30s in the countries of the world. So when we talk about quality of care, I think we don't win any arguments over the other countries.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about this whole question of innovation, because one of the things that I've experienced is when I talk to my friends who've lived in Europe and who have, you know, come back from, let's say, living a year in France or living a year in Germany or even living a year in England, they'll say things like, oh, it was just amazing. My kid got glasses every 6 months. All the medical care was fabulous. And they usually have incredibly positive responses to it.
Well, that could be. And there are good things about it. Maybe your friends had good experiences. I'd like to talk about this question of innovation and the modalities that were mentioned. Other nations have better healthcare outcomes than we do. You don't want to use that as the only measure of the success of the system, because obviously they have different baseline healthcare endowments and different populations, et cetera. We have a much more diverse population than most countries. So let's look at what I meant by innovation, which is the use of technology, the use of MRIs, the use of various imaging technologies, the use of pharmaceuticals. The use of biotech, all of those things, many of them come from the United States biotech, biomedical industry, and they're not going to keep innovating if they can't make a living, they can't make a profit, they can't make a high return. They're high-risk activities. If the government got involved in the degree that we're talking about, we're going to have a very stodgy, uninnovative system, because the political system will not stomach those costs and risks. They don't do it anywhere else. In Canada, they don't do it. They don't do it in the UK, the countries that I'm most familiar with. Their use of technology, their use of innovation, their production of technology innovation is way behind ours. And if we start to emulate them, we will become more like them.
Quentin, you want to respond?
Yes, of course. I think the presumptions that government is bad and profit-making is good is hard to prove. In this country in particular, we have enormous achievements by government interventions or government activities that dwarf whatever profit-seeking improvements we could mention. I'll start out with the National Institutes of Health. By far, the most successful way to fairly distribute research money, and on its own accounts for America's superiority in biotech, a government function by definition. I'm a little less enthusiastic about the operation of the profit motive in the healthcare system. It has its place. The healthcare system, the record of profit seeking is a mess and shame. And unless we fix it, we will go down as a nation economically and health-wise.
I want to push you a little bit, Quentin, on one of these issues. You say that healthcare should be a right, but as I start thinking about that, I'm saying, what part of healthcare should be a right? Just essential care? Who decides what's essential, what isn't? What about elective surgery? How do you go about deciding that?
I know how I would opt for deciding it, which is obviously the best way. Joke. The point is, there are standards. We have, in the world of medicine, which I inhabit, we have a whole array of standards based on best practices, constant review of experience. We don't have enough of that. We're moving into that age, and the technology helps us. But that's the answer to your question. What is the necessary and reasonable and appropriate. There are some things that are excluded by definition. By and large, these plans do not pay first dollar for cosmetic entities, and they don't allow you to get a drug because you want it, nor should they. But it's not as hard to set standards as your question implies. I really feel comfortable about that.
Russ?
Well, I think it's a lot harder to define standards when they move. If we want to say what the standard is today, yeah, it becomes fairly easy, I suppose. There's still going to be a political fight, as there is over anything the government does, and the decisions that the government makes are not done by experts. They're not done by good-hearted people. They're done by politicians and bureaucrats. And it's part of the sausage factory of special interests, which some of it comes out pretty well and some of it comes out pretty ugly. Again, I don't have any problem with someone who argues that we should move toward a more egalitarian system, but it is not free, and we have to face the cost. The cost is, I believe, a more mediocre system. That might be a cost worth paying. Much of what we pay for in healthcare right now isn't very effective. There's a lot of money wasted in the current system. There would be a lot of money wasted in a government system, but I think it would be a more static, less dynamic, and a tougher world for our great-grandchildren or grandchildren, maybe us.
I wanted to talk a little bit about employer-based health plans. People who have them love them. The numbers of people who have them are declining. Companies find them burdensome, I would imagine partly because they have to compete globally with European companies that don't have to shoulder such costs because the government takes it on. So I'd like you both to weigh in with the question whether it would be better for companies if they could get out of the health insurance business totally. You want to start, Quentin?
Of course that shouldn't be there, and it is indeed making us non-competitive with many areas of production, and it's a fluke. With this, the history of this is worthy of mention. It happened during World War II when there was a wage price freeze because we were in a war economy, and in an effort to entice the workers, which are in short supply with so many of our youth in the army, the companies joined with unions in asking, can we have perks that would let us compete better in the search for good workers? And the perks that were allowed included health care benefits. And the unions that time was not possible to push for better wages under the law. So they did push very hard and became very proud at these employment-based programs.
It's very important in this debate writ large, not our little debate, but the debate writ large, to remember that the goal of life isn't to have health insurance, and the goal of life isn't to have health care. The goal in life we're talking about is to have health. And a lot of times people talk about it as if the health care crisis is a problem of health insurance. They are related, obviously. If you're a person without health insurance, life is more anxious, and it could be less healthy if things go wrong and you can't afford to pay for it. But it's important to remember at the same time that our obsession with health insurance and health coverage, especially at the governmental level, is one of the reasons we spend so much money on health care. In a world where government was not involved in the health care market, in a world where we were relying on our own choices, which is what we do in many, many areas, and things come out great in the areas of food and shelter, many areas where we think, oh, they're crucial things, just like health care. People make free choices. The outcomes are very, very good. And the prices fall every year in real terms. Healthcare doesn't. And part of the reason for that, maybe the major reason, is because we subsidize it via the government. So to move further in that direction, I think would be to exacerbate and make this problem even worse.
What do each of you see as the best solution to our healthcare crisis? We'll start with you, Quentin.
Well, I've already revealed my hidden agenda. I think it's obvious that we must move to a single-payer national health insurance and take all the vast resources we have and make sure that everybody is in, nobody out, in contrast to the 47 million uninsured, which doesn't mean you're out. It just means you're just malfunctioning. You go to ERs at a high cost instead of a private physician for low cost. And that's just one of the areas that would be mended. There's an equal number probably of people with poor insurance that comes into play whenever they have a serious illness, they'd be mended. And then we could address, I'm sure this will get Russ's rage up, but we address the exorbitant profits for our pharmaceutical industries, which are confiscatory in that they don't, many people just can't afford them, even though they need them. And that's not a good society. So that's my answer, and I hope we're moving toward it rapidly.
Best solution, Russ?
Well, I have no rage, so I just I'll try to keep my ire down.
I apologize.
Pharmaceutical profits don't get me upset, and taking weight don't get me upset. What would get me upset is removing the incentive for pharmaceutical companies to innovate, which I think has been a great contributor to health. The cost of those profits, if we eliminated and made them zero, the impact on our healthcare expenditures would be basically not even in the decimal point. It would just—it's a very small fraction of the money that we spend on healthcare, and it happens to be a part that we spend that actually works surprisingly well. Not perfectly, obviously. There are things that are not perfect. But if I were to move to an ideal system, my ideal system would solve what I think is the major problem with the current healthcare system. The major problem with the current healthcare system is the separation between the consumer and the payer. We've seen that system work elsewhere badly. Education is the best example. Free education, which is a glorious idea, leads to mediocrity. It's what we see in most public school systems in the inner cities and even in some cities. So when I look around and I see how that system works, it doesn't work particularly well. I think healthcare, if we continue to move in that direction of free provision, having it financed by taxes, it would also not work very well, again, because the incentives are not there. So I want to move back to a world where people have the incentives both to provide good healthcare and to consume healthcare that is of value, and also the incentives to help people who are not able to afford healthcare, and the incentives to make the world a better place over the next 10, 20, 50, and 100 years. Our human creativity is our greatest gift. We will, I hope, continue to use it wisely. Providing free healthcare is a way, in my experience and looking around at other areas, to dampen that creativity, and it comes at a cost.
Russell Roberts is an economics professor at George Mason University. Quentin Young is a doctor who co-founded Physicians for a National Health Program. I love this discussion. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Massachusetts is on its way to making mental health care a right, at least for low-income children. Pediatricians are now required to do mental health screenings of their Medicaid patients. And some pediatricians are worried.
There's been more pressure on us as a professional group because we see kids in a first-line fashion to do more of that on our own. You know, we're in flu season, so there are lots and lots of other kinds of problems that we're dealing with in pediatrics, and mental health is not something you can do quickly.
And we'll hear about a group that was created to provide free health care in the developing world. These days, they're doing most of their work in rural America. Stay with us.
Justice Talking is produced by the Annenberg Public Policy Center, a think tank at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. The program is made possible with support from the Annenberg Foundation. The foundation works to advance public well-being through improved communication. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and West Legal Ed Center, where lawyers can listen to Justice Talking for MCLE credit online at westlegaledcenter.com. And from Oxford University Press, publisher of the United States Constitution, What It Says, What It Means, a Hip Pocket Guide. The Hip Pocket Constitution is available at justicetalking.org. This is NPR National Public Radio.
Justice Talking has entered the blogosphere. Each day, check out a new commentary from one of our contributors who cares passionately about law and justice issues. At justicetalking.org, you can also find forums where you can weigh in on the issues we cover on Justice Talking, like the environment, criminal justice, religious freedom, and elections. Continue the debate online with other Justice Talking listeners at justicetalking.org.